This is unbelievable. College basketball. Incredible.
You know they're going to try to run backdoor play if they can get it.
Under 10. Backdoor.
Goes out. Here's Davis. Davis for the win. He's got it. Princeton is going to the NCAA tournament.
I'm here with Craig Robinson, longtime friend, class of 83, graduate at Princeton, broadcaster, coach, father, brother, author, been most important for me, a good friend. And Craig, welcome to the show. It's really an honor to have you here.
Well, I should say, first of all, who's that guy you're talking about? No, Mitch, it's thank you for having me on this very first podcast. I couldn't tell you how excited I was when I told my wife, Kelly, that you were going to do this and we were going to do this podcast. And I've been giddy the whole time. And for those of folks out there who don't know, it's Memorial Day weekend, reunion weekend, and I've got a house full of people and I'm right here with you.
That's good. That's good. Well, that's where we want you. And, you know, you and I got a chance to get to know each other later in life for you. But for me, it was sort of fresh out of college. I was a young assistant at Northwestern, and we got started there in 2000 together. And, you know, I'd like to go back even further, if you don't mind. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, your sort of background in Chicago. But first, you were, you know, the son of Frazier and Marion Robinson. And I when we first started working together, we spent a lot of time on the road. And I heard all these great stories, which I'd like to talk about. But tell me about your parents and what it was like growing up, you know, in that household.
Yeah, well, it was fantastic in a word, but you can't use a word to describe how I felt growing up. And you really don't know the full extent of it until you become an adult. You and I both have families now, wife and kids, and you know when you have kids, you know, what it meant to grow up in a household like I did. And just to give you an idea, my dad worked for the city of Chicago, didn't go to college. He had MS from his...
What was he doing for the city?
He worked as a state... It was called a stationary fireman, but in the water department, there were guys who looked out for the boilers that they used to generate the energy for the water pressure. That was his job. And he went every day. And as I mentioned, he had MS. And from the time I can remember, he walked with a limp, got progressively worse. But he got up and went to work every single day. Yeah. And I don't remember. I remember him missing a day because he got the flu when I was really young. And I thought the world was coming to an end. And then the next time he missed work was when he passed away about 25 years ago.
Yeah. I remember you talking about, I mean, it seems like knowing you, how much he has influenced your life, but watching him put his shirt on in the mornings and how long that took him.
Yeah.
How early he would have to get up just to get dressed.
I mean, each sort of every few years, I could see him struggling more, and he would get up earlier and earlier because it took him a long time to get dressed. And he was not the type who would ask for help, but who needed help. He did it all on his own. And I just remember waking up with him in the mornings and watching him get ready. And it was like a normal childhood when you're next to your dad at the sink and he's shaving and getting ready. I was standing there right next to him, and, you know, he never asked for any extra help. So that was my dad. And then my mom was a homemaker all the way up until my sister and I got into high school. Then she went back to work as a secretary. And the real thing that I remember about our upbringing was that there was just a whole lot of unconditional love in the house that sort of buoyed everybody up. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first.
What was that like? And what do you mean?
It showed itself in many different ways. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money, but we never felt like we were poor. We did things like go to the drive-in, and we did things like have these wonderful Christmases. Our parents participated in all of our school activities. My mom was up at our school all the time, contributing her time and her effort, not just to Michelle and I, but to the all the kids in, yeah. in our respective classrooms. So, you know, it's not always about what they can provide for you materialistically, but that was part of it. I mean, you know, one of the fondest memories I had was that every single Friday night, no matter how tough things were, and they were tough at times, I didn't know it at the time, but we would have a treat for dinner on Friday. And that treat could be pizza. It could be McDonald's when it first opened up. I mean, going to McDonald's back then was like going to a four-star restaurant. And every Friday, my dad would act as if my mom had so much work all week that she needed Friday night off from preparing dinner. And it was just one of those things that made you feel like you weren't poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's, I remember one of my favorite stories that I've actually stolen and told a couple times, talked to recruits is your dad came home with his paycheck in cash once. And tell me that story real quick. I just think
this was a great parental move. Yeah. And I cannot wait to do it with my own kids. But I didn't have any idea about the value of money. I knew how to count money and I knew how to spend it, but I didn't know the value of it, which a lot of kids nowadays growing up, they get a lot of education, but not a lot of financial education. So some kid at school said, "Hey, Craig, you know what? You're rich." You know, we probably were fighting over something. And he's like, "You don't know what you're talking about. You're just a rich kid." And I was like, I thought to myself, maybe we are rich. And I just didn't know it. And I did what I typically would do when somebody would say something I wasn't sure about. I went right to my dad and I said, "Dad," he came home from work. And I almost remember it as if it was yesterday. It was hot out. It was a nice hot summer day. He had come home. He was tired, but he was never too tired to have a discussion or play ball. And I said, "Dad, are we rich?" And my dad never reacted too quickly. This is one of the things that I learned about him that I used in my coaching later and in my parenting. You never react too quickly because mm-hmm. you don't know how it's going to affect your kids. Right. And he said to me, he's like, "Why? What made you ask that?" And I said, "Well, this kid at school said that we were rich, and I just want to know, are we rich?" And he said, "Well, you know what? I'm not going to answer that right now. I'm going to show you." And I said, "Let's talk about this." He said, "Let's talk about this on Friday." And Friday was when he got his paycheck. Mm-hmm. So he got his paycheck that Friday in cash. Cash money, cash, whatever it was. Let's just use $100 for a round amount. And he laid it out on the bed in
$1 million.
And the first thing out of my mouth was, "We are rich." And he said, No, wait a minute. Now you have to pay rent, and rent is $30 a month. And so he took $30 out. And then I was like, "Nice, okay. We got a lot of money left over." He's like, wait, what else do you need?" And I said, "Well, you got to buy groceries and this and that." And so he said, "Okay, groceries." And he said, "You think that car out there is free? You have to pay each month on the car." And all of this, all these things are going through my brain. And he slowly but surely, to make a long story short, gets down to the very end. And he's gone through the bills, the electric bill, the phone bill, the car note. And there's $20 left. And I said, "Man, $20, that's still a lot of money." And he's like, "Wait, don't forget Friday night pizza, you and Michelle's allowance." Mm-hmm. And at the very end of it, there was about $8 left.
Yeah.
And I, as you know, remember that story and tell it all the time because it was such a, it did a couple of things. First of all, it made me understand at a very young age the value of the things that are around you and the things that you are fortunate enough to have in your life. But secondly, it helped me to be able to help others understand that because one of the first things he did when he said, well, there's rent, he said right after the rent and the car note, he said, you have to pay yourself first. Mm-hmm. And he put money into the savings and it was, you know, $10 or 10% or whatever it was. It taught me the value of saving and paying your, I always called it paying yourself because that's how he said, you got to pay yourself. Yeah. And that is such a novel concept and such a, it's so plain and simple that it goes over people's heads all the time.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed that story so much. And also, I think, knowing your family, it's one of those stories that it makes a lot of sense when you get to know you guys. And, you know, talk about, if you don't mind, being a hoops podcast in some ways, but we both are on the same boat in terms of, the person is defined by the game and the game defines the person. But talk about Mount Carmel, going to school there, your coach, and how that influenced you.
Yeah, well, I went to, as you said, Mount Carmel High School, and that wasn't my first introduction to basketball. I actually got started playing biddy basketball and had a really good AAU coach named Johnny Gage, who was not much older than we were, who started me on basketball. And then I went to Mount Carmel and played for a couple of different coaches, but I had this one, my sophomore year, I played on the sophomore team, and Father Mike Father Mike O'Keefe was my coach. And it was the first time in my life I had ever had a priest as a coach. And, one of the things that I learned from him that I remember was every now and then I'd be waiting for my bus. I took a city bus to get to school. And the reason why I didn't go to my neighborhood school and I went to a Catholic school, my parents were very big on education. Mount Carmel would provide the best education.
And what was your neighborhood?
For me, it was South Shore in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it was, when I first moved in, it was predominantly black neighborhood with a few white folks in there. And by the time I went to high school, it was probably 100% black and Hispanic.
And what is it now?
It is the same. And my mom still lives in the house that I grew up in. So, and there's a high school right nearby there, South Shore High School, which wasn't the best at the time. And I ended up going to Mount Carmel. But I would take a city bus, and Father Mike would come by once a week. The timing of him coming by my neighborhood, he saw me, picked me up, and would give me a ride to school one day. But what I didn't realize was that, and I, as you know, I'm an early riser. Even back then, I got to school earlier than I should have. He was coming from a grammar school where he would do mass even before he'd come to our school and coach basketball, teach English, and do mass at our school. And it was one of those things that just struck you about how much people do for others and no one knows it. Yeah. I mean, he never talked about the many things that he did for other people that wasn't being a basketball coach or that wasn't at Mount Carmel High School.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? Like when you know, the story leading up to your arrival at Princeton is so layered. And, it's one of the things that I enjoy hearing about and talking about. So, how did you get to Princeton?
This is one of my very favorite stories because it was one of those things that I don't want to say it was serendipitous, but there was a high likelihood that I wasn't going to Princeton. And first and foremost, Princeton was the only school I applied to. Every other school I was getting recruited to play, so I didn't apply to any other schools.
And why was that?
Well, when you come from my background where neither one of your parents went to college, you're just thinking going to college. You weren't thinking of – I certainly wasn't thinking of going to an Ivy League school. Mm. As a matter of fact, let's take a step back before I made the decision. I didn't even know about Princeton other than watching the Flintstones when they did Princeton and Shale.
Yeah.
That was all I knew about the Ivy League. I knew I had some in the they call it blogosphere now, or in the nether regions of my mind, I had heard of Princeton.
You know, things haven't changed that much. Some kid we talked to, you know, where do you know any much about Princeton?
Yeah, amazing. Like New Jersey.
Yeah, Central.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So, but a former Princeton grad was running a basketball camp, and I went to it, and Coach Tony Relvis, who was the assistant to Coach Carrill when I was in high school, saw me play. And this guy who ran the camp, and it was a top 100 camp in the Midwest, and I played well, and he said, this kid's got grades, and sort of that was the introduction. Well, I subsequently go on a visit to the school, and Coach Carrill does what Coach Carrill does, and he told me why I was a bad basketball player, and I was like, huh, this is interesting. This is the only player, the only person who's ever told me what I need to work
right,
on.
Which is common for what he used to do
it's
to a lot of people.
Now I know that, and it's a shame that it doesn't work as much now. I mean, kids nowadays, I feel, are missing out because they want to be with somebody who's just going to tell them
right.
the good stuff.
I remember distinctly, you can't dribble with your left hand, you're an okay shooter, but we'd like to have you.
Yeah.
And I remember telling that story thinking it was just me, but pretty much everybody.
It was all of us. Yeah. And he got you with, but we'd like to have you. And it was such a great sales pitch because it's like, here's a guy who wants me warts and all. And so it was a novel approach. But I had a wonderful recruiting trip here. And I stayed with John Rogers, who was a fellow Chicagoan.
So John Rogers, class of 1980, who at the time was either going to be the captain of the team.
He was already, because the season was, I can't remember if the season was over. No, it was probably the start of the season because you didn't do trips as a junior.
Yeah.
So it was the fall of my senior year.
Okay. And I do want to talk about John because he's played a big part in your life and also mine. And John's been very influential on a lot of Princeton basketball alums' lives and also Princetonians.
Yeah. Yeah, he sure has. And so I ended up staying with him, Steve Mills, Randy Melville, who are both Princeton grads, 1981, were on the team. Rahman Kareem was on the JV team. He's class of 80. William Murphy was class of 82. He was trying out for the team. All of these guys ended up being my friends for life, and I had the best recruiting trip. Now, let's jump ahead to the spring where you have to make your decision. And now I'm being recruited by the University of Washington, which was the Pac-8 back then, University of Texas Arlington, Division I, but who knew a University of Texas Arlington? And then very, very lightly by Kentucky State University, those three schools.
You didn't know that was going to be used against you later at your time here.
I had no idea, because as you know, Coach Carrill used to use that against me. The only other school who was recruiting you was Texas Arlington, and you always use Texas Arlington. I was like, Coach, University of Washington was recruiting me too, but that's another story for another time. So we lived in this very small one-bedroom house, and we had our kitchen and where we ate dinner was the same place. We didn't have a dining room, so my mom was doing the dishes, and very typical after dinner banter going back and forth. And my mom's doing the dishes with her back to me. My dad's across from me, and he says, so, well, what do you think? What do you think in school-wise? And I said, and I was very ready for this discussion. And I said, well, Dad, I think I'm going to the University of Washington. And my dad did what dads do when you make the wrong decision. He paused. And now for the audience out there, you can't see this because he didn't say a word, but I'm lifting my head up so that my neck is showing. And he stroked his neck a few times. And that was what he did when he was very disappointed. So I'm thinking, oh, my God, what have I done? And then he put his chin to his chest and started sort of rubbing his chin against his chest, shaking it left to right.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of what have I done wrong? And he very calmly says, well, tell me, how did you come to this decision? And I said, well, the University of Washington has a great engineering program. At the time, I thought I was going to be an engineer. I said, it's in the Pac-8. It's a great conference, and I think I could be able to play by the time I'm a junior. Mm-hmm. And the last but not least, and the Princetonians out there know this, but the non-Princetonians don't or may not. Princeton didn't offer scholarships, so I said, and I can go for free. And what my father, who worked hard his whole life, said to me was, well, if you pick your school based on how much I have to pay, I'm going to be very disappointed. And
when he said something like that, it resonated.
When he was disappointed, the whole house was disappointed. I mean, you know, here's a guy who has done everything for us and you never wanted to disappoint him. So he said to me, he said, why don't you think about it and come back and we'll talk tomorrow. And the next day, the whole thing plays out almost exactly the same. And I said, well, Dad, you know, I actually did like Princeton the best. And he said, fine, you'll go. And that was it. You're done. And he wouldn't let me out of that one statement. That was all that could come out of my mouth.
It's so interesting. I do think about that a lot, too. You know, the conversations today with kids aren't that different, but I hear a lot more, whatever he wants, we'll support him. And I do think there's a shared sort of moment with parents and the kids that we do recruit now where, the kids that have really thrived here, there's a parent in their ear, there's somebody in their ear saying, this is the right place for you, and the kid kind of knows it.
Yeah, and I think where we're missing out a lot on is that parents are scared to tell their kids what the right or wrong decision is or give their opinion even though it doesn't actually agree with them. I think we do our kids a disservice because that's what parenting is. Parenting is guidance and counsel, and you can't do that by being completely objective. You it's very subjective when your children are involved. So I applaud the fact that my parents sort of aimed me in the right direction.
Right, because and I can't tell you how many kids I know that it's a sacrifice for a family, but also sometimes a kid just wants to do the right thing for his family, and it requires a little bit of a nudge saying, okay, we're going to be okay.
Right.
And let's talk about what you're at Princeton. For those of you that don't know, I used to always joke that when you're sitting in a car and you used to drive a kind of a bigger SUV when I first met you. You know, you might think that you're about 5'11", and you step right out of the car because the torso is, you know, you're, proportionally you're built very well for basketball, but you have 7-foot-long wingspan. Two-time Ivy League Player of the Year, just a terrific career at Princeton. But go back to the beginning, arriving on campus and your first exposure to the program, some of the players that were there, and Coach Carroll.
Yeah, well, I can remember the first day like it was yesterday because there was no what we all do now, and I've done it for my kids, driving them to school and getting them set up. There wasn't any of that because we couldn't afford it. So my first day, I had a suitcase and a duffel bag, and I landed at Newark Airport, took the bus that you could get from Newark that dropped you off right on Nassau Street, and I got off. And I have this stuff, and I'm wondering, what the heck do I do now? And you just sort of figure it out. And I got to tell you, Mitch, that if I didn't have the support system of the basketball team, I might not have made it at Princeton.
Yeah.
And I say that because, you know, this place is full of top-notch everything. Whether it's a basketball player, a student, a pianist, everybody has something that they do extremely well, along with some other stuff that they got going on for them where they're really good at it. And, you know, when you're coming from the south side of Chicago and, you know, I was never much of a studier. I was more of a test taker. I can sort of get by. It was very daunting that first year. And then on top of it, you got Coach Carroll telling you how you're probably not going to make the team. And I was thinking, well, I thought I was on the team once I said I was coming. Right.
And you got recruited by Texas Arlington.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you have a daughter here now, and, you know, it's I would imagine you've talked to her. It's pretty different. And the exposure to the place is presented differently, and which I think is a really – not that it was bad –
It's just different. I mean, Princeton has learned how to be more welcoming for all types, and I don't mean just all types racially, but socioeconomically, and international students, ADA students. I mean, it's just I think Princeton is always on the forefront of getting better. But when I look back on my days here playing basketball, when I thought that I wasn't good enough or I wasn't smart enough or wasn't likable enough to fit in, I always had that support system of the basketball team. And it's really it really shows now. At the time, I didn't realize it when I saw all these alums coming back, especially on the basketball team. I didn't understand it until I had gone through it a couple of years, and I realized that now all of these guys knew who I was, not just the guys I went to school. So you have this culture of support and culture of excellence and culture of success that gave me a self-confidence that a lot of young people need, especially when they're in college, because people think you're already developed. I think you are, but from a self-esteem standpoint, you're still trying to figure out who you are.
We definitely know that, you know, when you graduate from here, you think you've got it all figured out, but usually when you figure it out, it's time to graduate. But, you know, we just bumped into TJ Bray on the way over here, who's back for reunions weekend, and that's one of the things that's harder to put your finger on when you're describing the place to somebody, but you know who he is. You know, he's a good player here, 2014 graduate. He's playing professionally in Italy.
Right.
But also just the connectivity between former players.
Yeah.
And how we'll do anything for each other. Let's go back to John Rogers really quickly, if you don't mind. Because when you got here, John was a senior. And then talk about your relationship with John, because it's been a powerful relationship for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of my longest relationships because, you know, outside of the guys I went to high school with, and it's only a couple of those guys that I stay in touch with. But as I mentioned, I first met John on my recruiting trip here, and he has been a dear, dear friend and mentor the entire time, because I only got a year to play with him. He was a senior when I was a freshman, and watching him, because, you know, John was the captain of the team and started his first game of his senior year, and then his playing time tailed off, and watching him navigate through Coach Kirill and that whole situation, I always admired how he came to work every day playing hard and trying to contribute to the team, whether he was on the court or off the court, in practice, out of practice. And so obviously we stayed in touch, and John went into the finance business early. And when I was done playing, you know, I was fortunate enough to get drafted and play overseas. And when I was done playing, John was the person I asked, what should I do now? I have no idea how to go about doing anything.
And people are still doing that with John.
And he's still providing fantastic advice and counsel to anybody, but especially Princeton grads and Princeton basketball
He's always
grads.
Available, and it's really an incredible trait of his that, you know, he'll check in with me during the season when, you know, if you have a tough loss or a moment when you're he just checks in.
Yeah.
He's calling to say hi.
And it's been a relationship that I've really sort of leaned on over the years. I mean, he's the reason I got into the investment in banking, the investment world, first and foremost. And then, we played on men's leagues teams together. You and I have played on 3-on-3 teams with him together.
Right, the hoop it up teams, which has been one of John's passions outside of, you know, working at Ariel for years. And I sort of got into your orbit once you and I started working together. But one of the teams that we played on was Kit, Arnie, Duncan, who, you know, Brian Earle, and you and I, and John was a coach. And, you know, I was sort of on the tail end of that a little bit, but those are incredible times together. As you get older, you know, we talk about this a lot, where you're spoiled, a little bit spoiled playing the way we played, but it was always John's passion for to play the right way.
You know, it's
carried over.
That's right, Mitch. And it was almost as if he felt the need to pass it along to the rest of the world, that this is how good players should play, because if they played this way, they would be even better. And we were 10, 15 years of playing 3-on-3 yeah. basketball and pickup basketball. But really, the friendship and the guidance that John has provided over the years to all of, you know, both Princeton men and women basketball players yeah. has been tremendous for the program and for Princeton.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to just jump ahead a little bit. But first, you know, so Michelle, after you're a student here, you know, comes and visits and sort of introduced to Princeton because of, you know, your introduction to Princeton. And, you know, I've seen you speak publicly for a long time. You're very good at it. You have a very good ease about you when you're speaking. And, you know, I know that that's probably a natural part of you, but you've worked at it. So describe to me, if you could, what it was like introducing your sister at the 2008 Democratic National Convention in August, and sort of set the stage for me. And, you know, again, I'm jumping ahead, but I think it's a good segue from, you know, your time at Princeton and sort of how much things had evolved for you and for her in 2008.
Yeah, well, you know, and let me just address the her going to Princeton, because there's a good story behind that. You know, she applied to the University of Illinois. She did more applying to schools than I did, but she applied to Princeton, and she told her guidance counselor at her high school that she'll apply to these other schools because she has to, but she knows that she's going to Princeton. And the guidance counselor said, "Are you kidding? This is one of the hardest schools in the world to get in. What makes you think you're just going to get into Princeton?" She said, "Well, I'm a much better student than my brother is, and he's at Princeton already. So I know I'm getting it." And it's absolutely true. There's no bragging at that whatsoever. I mean, I couldn't be more proud of the way she attacks her education and her work. And I mean, she was almost a perfectionist. So
much has changed what we know
of
her now.
Not much has changed. And you know, to be able to, and forget about her potentially being the first lady at the time, I was just absolutely over the moon excited that I could introduce my little sister and tell a few stories that would hopefully make people laugh, make people think, and make people cry, and just get to know her in that short bit of time. And
what was it like being Michelle's older brother for a long time, and then you're Michelle's brother?
Yeah.
And not Craig Robinson.
Yeah. Well, it you know, for her entire life up until that point, she was Craig's little sister, always was. She'd go to basketball games. "Hey, you're Craig's little sister. Hey, how you doing? You know, you're Craig's sister, you're Craig's sister, you're Craig's sister." And then I stand up in front of all those people and on TV, and I introduce her. And then she gives one of the best speeches I've ever heard at a Democratic National Convention, but I am a little biased. And I go in a split second from her being Craig's little sister to me being Michelle Obama's big brother. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't have been happier for it. And it's been just a wonderful ride. But the introduction itself was, I've gotten to introduce her a lot since then, but that first one was really near and dear to my heart, because it really gave me a chance to brag on my little sister.
I bet. Yeah, I remember. You know, we haven't ever talked about this because, you know, those of us that were close to you, it was during those moments in the run-up to the 2008 election and even the 2012 election, but really the 2008 election, it was stressful. It was, and intense. And I remember during the inauguration, there's a dinner And I can't remember the name of the dinner, but you're there, and President Obama is walking by you. And at that point, you know, for you, he was Barack, right? He was Michelle's husband. And I remember distinctly that there's a great shot of you stand up and you're like, "Mr. President, how are you?" You know, could you describe a little bit of what that transition was like from your perspective?
Well, it was, is, and probably always will be surreal. I mean, let me tell you, Mitch, it's been 7.5 years, not that I'm counting, but and it is still mind-boggling every time I sort of try and wrap my arms around the fact that my sister's the First Lady and my brother-in-law is the President of the United States. And, you know, we spend Thanksgiving and different family times at the White House. And, you know, my two younger kids have no idea who their uncle really is. They just know him as Uncle Barack. That's as an example, my 6-year-old is in kindergarten. And when we told him that Uncle Barack won't be president after next year, you know what he said? He didn't cry and he didn't ask why he wouldn't be able to go back to the White House. You know what he said? He said, "So which one of my uncles is going to be president next?"
Man, that's a classic 6-year-old comment.
Which uncle is going to be president? It's like, sorry, this isn't a family business, but it's been an honor. You know, I want to say that to watch them operate and serve the country the way they have. And but it is one of those things that you know, if we were a political family and sort of were used to this and people were raised to do this, I might feel differently. But it is it's almost shocking every time I go through those gates.
Yeah, I can't imagine. But, you know, you were a coach. We were assistants together, and then you became a head coach. And, you know, did you feel like, as a head coach, it prepared you in some way for understanding what she was going through on a smaller level, or did you feel like?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, any kind of, you know, I think any kind of managerial position, you can sort of extrapolate, because what you're really in the business of is people.
Yeah.
And it's just that our decisions, you win and lose games. His decisions are much bigger, and things can happen that affect a whole lot of people. And I've always been an admirer of the president's way of dealing with stress. And it's very similar to the way you and I deal with stress. He works out and he watches basketball. I mean, now he's got to deal with some heavy, heavy stuff. And so I think being close to the president has made me have a better outlook on what I do. Yeah. There's a lot more important things out there than winning games.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's the winning games part of coaching. I don't think there's anything more important than what you're doing in opening up the lives of these young men that you coach. There's not enough talked about there. Everybody's talking about players getting paid and everybody somehow taking a bite out of this gigantic golden goose. And you miss out on the fact that most of these basketball players and student athletes are not going, this is their last chance at being in a sport. And you're probably the last person who's not paying them who's sort of guiding them, because the next stop is work, and that's the real world.
Yeah. Well, you make a good point that that it's easy to talk about now, because here we are sort of on the cusp of reunions weekend here at Princeton, and you got a lot of alums coming back, but also a lot of former players. And I think you and I would both agree, we sort of, you know, what I want for my current guys is what we had. Great, significant, meaningful relationships with the guys on your team, you know, a chance to play meaningful basketball and hopefully, you know, let it carry on for forever. And then use your, you know, what you learn here to carry on to the next steps. You're now currently broadcasting with ESPN, Craig, and talk about, if you don't mind, you know, what's that like compared to coaching? Because I've always had this thing in my head about a lot of coaches watch games, listen to the broadcasters and think, I could do that. And I've always felt like, and we've talked about this briefly, but it's a lot more to it. And you're now, I think, going into year two, and it's tough. And you did a significant number of games a year ago. You know, walk me through what that's like.
Well, first of all, I was one of those guys who thought I would never be a broadcaster because I didn't think that a lot of them could understand my team and what I was trying to do. They were just calling a game. But once I had the opportunity to audition and try it out, I thought, you know, this is very hard to do, and I need to give these guys more the benefit of the doubt.
What's hard about it?
I'll tell you what's hard. Well, first of all, you are preparing not as if you're coaching against the one team, so you're not focused on one team. You're focused on both teams, and as a result, you're focused on the entire conference that you're working in or calling the game in, which could be a different, and especially in the non-conference, could be totally, completely different conferences. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of preparation, and there is a ton of preparation that goes into being prepared. And so that's one thing. The other thing is talking about basketball in short bursts while you're trying to describe a game for people that they're watching is an art. It's learned behavior. Very few people I've seen are naturals at it. Mm-hmm. And I've been extremely fortunate working at ESPN with a group of producers and play-by-play people and directors who have embraced helping me get better. And the way you get better is by doing reps. So if I'm watching a game with my team and it's that color man's first time doing it, he's not going to sound good. He's not going to sound like Jay Billis.
Yeah.
Jay Billis has been doing this for 25 years. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot that goes into the preparation side. Then you have to have a knowledge of what the other teams are doing. So I spend a lot of time on the day before the game getting into town and hopefully going to the practice right. of the home team. And if the away team is going to practice that night, I try and go to their practice as well.
And I bet that would be interesting from, you know, your perspective as a head coach. Like what have you seen that you liked and what you didn't like?
Exactly. I mean, I have a list, a file at home that I keep with all the things in my next job that I will do differently, all the things that I would do the same, and then some things that I would want to try that I've never tried, and things that I just absolutely would never do. So,
and as you watch the college game, do you see the game, you know, is it growing? How do you see it sort of transition? Because when you're coaching a team, you're really like locked in. You're in the trenches with your own staff and your players and the recruiting sort of front, but you're getting an opportunity to see the way a lot of different people do it. And we all know there's a lot of different ways to do this.
There are
a lot of different ways of success.
There are a ton of ways of doing it. But to get to your question on where I'm seeing the game going is I'm seeing it move away from player development, which is what we always learn playing and coaching and getting coached by Princeton coaches. You know, I always tell people, you know what the Princeton offense is? The Princeton offense is unselfishness and player development. If you think about being unselfish on the court and you think about how you have to develop as a player, that's really the foundation of the backdoor cuts and the being able to make shots and all that stuff. What I'm seeing is that there is less emphasis on player development and more emphasis on getting the type of guys you can get that'll help you win right away. And that's just a function of the way the business is, because if you don't win in 3 years, 4 years tops, you're going to get fired and they're going to give another guy a chance. So
it's funny you mentioned that. So Barkley came out recently within the last couple of weeks and sort of blasted a little bit of a style of play. And it was a lot of talk about where Jordan's teams have beaten the current Warriors team. And Barkley's point was like, that doesn't really matter. The point is, it's just bad basketball, which is, you know, the Warriors are arguably the sort of, you know, one of the better teams. They're in a little trouble right now, but I think what he was trying to say was development. It's not the same. You screen and roll, driving kicks. It's a different game.
Yeah, and it may be more exciting to folks who like high-scoring games and want to see a lot of possessions. But for those of us who think we can defend that, it would be interesting to see, and we're starting to see it with OKC, mm-hmm. that – what happens if you keep these guys from making three-point shots? What do they have to do next? And that's one of the things about Princeton basketball that I've always loved, and that I think Coach Kirill gets and Coach Carmody subsequently get very little credit for, is how we always were prepared. But if for some reason we ran up against somebody who was prepared for us, we had an alternate plan that we could go to, or that the coaching staff would come up with either in game or for the next time you were playing. And I think that's what's getting lost in this day and age. I mean, forget, like, I'm with Barkley. Forget about who's better. It's just, you know, I want to be the guy that Coach Kirill was. Here are the things that you need to work on. Why don't you work on it? Because ultimately coaching is teaching. And that's why I got into this, is because I enjoy teaching people and sharing the things that I was fortunate enough to learn from a bunch of people going all the way back to my mom and dad.
You mentioned coaching, and I found it, you know, your daughter Leslie is a sophomore. She's going to be a junior next year. Talk about, if you, you know, explain kind of what it was like being, you know, forever you're on the one side, right? We're talking, we're selling the school, we're selling ourselves, we're discussing with recruits and with families the things that we think are, that they should be thinking about. You're on the other side of it. Your daughter's getting recruited. What was that like? And then what's it like watching her and being in the stands, you know, wearing orange and black?
Well, let me just say, when I came to Princeton, it's probably the same for you. It might not have been for you, because I think you had some family members who went here. I didn't know what the word legacy meant. I heard that word when I came to Princeton, and I was like, huh, I wonder, what do they mean by legacy? And I always thought it was sort of a tradition of just sort of coming to Princeton. I didn't have any idea what a legacy was. And now that Leslie is a legacy, I'm almost embarrassed that I didn't know what it was before. Right. But it just gives me a really warm feeling, and knowing that I had such a good experience here and that she chose this. And might I say, I couldn't pull the Fraser Robinson and tell her I was disappointed if she picked the wrong school, because, you know, it's a little bit different when you've gone to a school and you played basketball there. And then I have a daughter who's playing and getting recruited by the same school. I didn't want her to feel like she had to pick Princeton because I went to Princeton. And then, you know, my daughter was also very conscious of the fact that my sister went here, and, you know, you'll see with Pippa as she gets older, with daughters, if you're the dad and you tell her what to do, she's going to go in the other direction. So, you know, I had to lay like a bear trap there and let her step right into it. But I couldn't have been more excited when, I tell you, Courtney Banghart wanted to recruit her, and she recruited Leslie like Leslie needed to be recruited. And so that part was easy. I just stayed out of the way. But being able to go to watch their games and watch them play and watch them practice, that's been a real treat. And, you know, I've said to you and I've said to Courtney, because people ask me all the time, you know, wouldn't you love to coach that team? Talking about Courtney's team, I said, are you kidding me? I don't want to coach that team. I want to be on that team.
Yeah. Yeah, a year ago, you know, when they had that sort of great run, Leslie was a freshman. They were, you know, they were pounding teams, and there was just a magic about that group. I think a lot of people around here, you know, it was so fun to be around that group as they headed into the tournament.
Yeah, yeah,
it was a really special,
really
season.
Really a treat.
And you mentioned Courtney too. Like that's doesn't surprise me to hear that. You know, she has a way of, you know, I think. You know, what's the expression, sell ice to an Eskimo? I mean,
yeah,
she can do it. I mean, she's and she really understands what each girl needs.
Yeah. And I've just found, at least in Leslie's case, and I'm sure this is the case for a lot of girls, she's found the right coach for her soul, mm-hmm. you know, her personality, her being. It's just great. And you just see her face light up when she comes home and she's excited to always go back. And, you know, now I know how my parents felt when they were sending me off to Princeton.
I bet you that feels good. When we worked together, I sort of came up with a nickname for you and called you the Edge.
Yes.
And I wanted to go back and go back to that a little bit because – you know, you're a very delightful person to be around. And we were playing, I don't know if you remember this, at Pepperdine. We were at Northwestern. We were at Pepperdine on the road. And you and I went down and played on the beach. And I think we were in Venice Beach. And we wanted to just get a workout. And we were playing. Both of us were still playing a lot. And you, at the time, like, you're a terrific outside shooter. But that was a learned skill for you. And you got a lot better shooting, you know, as we got older. And I think somebody drived and kicked you the ball. You were like several feet behind the 3-point line and you made it. And some guy on the other team says, no, that was a 2. And you were like, no, that's a 3. It should be a 4. And I just like, it never left my mind. Like, I was like, who is this person that just showed up? And it's you. And
so out of character. Yeah. Out of character. Well, there is something about playing basketball that has made me and I won't say it at Princeton I didn't have that edge, and you and I have talked about this. It wasn't until I had children that I developed this edge that you have to have to sort of be the protector and the provider. And it's almost embarrassing because it comes out when I'm playing in a friendly pickup game on Venice Beach, which should be the most fun thing to do, because you're being nice because there was a lot of other talking
going on.
Good.
Yeah. Well, it's a family podcast.
Yes. Right. But that is it, and it's something that's kind of, I'm glad I have it. It has served me well over the years because you're right. I hope that I am delightful in most social settings, but every now and then you have to stick up for your friends and your family and yourself, and you need to have that edge, but it has to be genuine. It cannot be forced because, you know, if it's forced, people who do have an edge can sniff it out just like dogs can.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I would imagine, you know, you have a number of very close friends, you know, from Princeton and from your time here. And, you know, that the edge comes in certain moments, but around friends, around your closest friends, you know, it's an opportunity for all of us to sort of, and that's, I think, one of the benefits of playing on a team. We all get a chance to call each other out on a little bit because, you know, I mean, we've all got our little things. But tell me a little bit about, you know, some of your teammates and how you've stayed in touch, and also about, you know, how you, and I think that's one of the things about going to a school like Princeton and playing on a team that doesn't get, it's hard to put your finger on it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Now, you, we talked about John Rogers.
Yeah.
Now, he's somebody who we call each other to check in, and, you know, he has done a lot of work at the White House for my brother-in-law and my sister, and, you know, so he's, in a group by himself. But then there are the guys who I played with a lot, who I see more now that I live in the area than I did when I was out west. But
and you're in New Jersey now.
I'm in New Jersey now, so there is a proclivity of running into guys. I can come back for the alumni banquet and the golf outing, and so I see guys more often. But Steve Mills was a junior when I was a freshman, along with Randy Melville. And I mentioned Rahman Kareem, who was a senior, He was in John Rogers' class when I was a freshman. And William Murphy and I, he went out for the team, didn't make the team, but always went out for the team and was a basketball player. And Steve Mills, another guy, Steve Williams, who is since deceased, William Murphy and myself had a DJ crew on campus, so we DJ parties together. We all are on a group chat.
Did you guys have a name?
It was called the Playboy Crew. That was our name. And we were very proud of that name and group.
That's great.
But we did, you know, parties all over campus in eating clubs and everywhere, student center. And we are still very close some 30 years later. And during these playoffs right now, we have a group text where we're going back and forth talking about the game, talking about life. And, you know, it's ironic that I'm here today because I was just reminiscing about playing basketball at Princeton. And Murph, who I was saying, is still salty that he didn't make the team. And the fact that he didn't have the same group of memories that we had regarding the team. And it was at that point that I realized, I was like, look, it was because of Princeton that we are all friends right now and dear friends, close friends. Any one of us would drop what we're doing to go and help the other. And so those are the types of relationships that you develop over the years. So that's one group. And then there's another group of guys who you don't stay in contact as much. You know, I played with Gordon Enderle, who I talked to two or three times a year, Rich Simkus. You know, I live not too far from Jeff Pagano. And you know, and then I meet you working and we develop this great friendship. And it just, you know, Neil Crystal, I would see at the Final Four every year.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
Reading,
just
not too far away.
Yeah, and these are just Princeton basketball guys, because there's some Princeton football and guys who played other sports that I stay in touch with. Rick Giles being one who played, graduated in 83, played football at Princeton. So, and I could go on and on. I mean, I don't want to name too many because I'm probably leaving somebody out who deserves to be mentioned, but. It is.
I think we got what we needed with the Playboy Crew. That's it. So I'm going to see Steve later, and that's going to come up.
But it's just, you know, as I've gotten older, you know, it's just more important to have those warm feelings when you talk about your friends in the past and not have this sort of bitter thing hanging over us. And while we always tease Coach Kirill about the things he said to us and how we thought they were the meanest things ever. And now, of course, there's revisionist history. He always claims that he never said anything. And it's interesting how he does that. Now my mom does that. It's like everybody who's older than me forgets all about the things they said they were negative. And it was all because of you know, Coach Kirill and Princeton basketball. And
it's funny how he does that. He can remember the score of the football game that he coached when he was JV football coach. But he doesn't remember that he, you know.
He doesn't remember calling me Father Time. Actually, Grandfather Time. Yeah. Father Time was Neil Crystal because he got tired. And I got tired more than Neil did, so he called me Grandfather Time.
So now that we're talking about Coach, maybe we can finish on this. How about, a you know, again, family podcast? A Coach Kirill story.
Oh, it's not possible on a family podcast.
Well,
it's not possible to. I mean, what I will say about Coach Kirill, and all joking aside, he is outside of my dad when it came to showing you how to work at your craft. You know, my dad gave me the work ethic, how you just have to work hard. And you always think, or I did, thought I was working hard until I came to Princeton and realized that what leadership is taking someone like me who thought he was doing something hard and showing him how he could do it harder and be better at it. Mm-hmm. And I think that as much as we talk about the Coach Carrill stories and things he said and did, we don't talk enough about how much better we all got as basketball players and people playing for Coach Carrill. And I wanted to emphasize that people part because we've all been able to take that work ethic and be successful at something else. And
I think that stands out. I mean, again, another story I remember that you and I have talked about with your dad was, you know, Coach really respected your dad. And he came one time, and I don't think he came too often. And Coach was on the court, maybe with a lit cigar. And
yeah. Well, that's a good story, man. I'm glad you brought that up because that is a family friendly story. And you know, everyone knows that Coach Carrill used very colorful language all the time on the court. It didn't matter who was in the gym. And you know, Coach Carrill had been to my house in my living room, met my dad, and you could not say a bad thing to him about my dad. Yeah. And I think Coach Carrill treated me with a great deal of, what do I want to say? He treated me with a great deal of respect because of my dad.
Well, he had a connection to people like your dad and you, because it was not too different from his upbringing, you know, his son of a Bethlehem steel maker. And
so he knew hard work, yeah. And he knew sacrifice more than anything. And one of the guys I mentioned, Gordon Enderle, who was playing alongside, we were on the same team, and he's a forward on one side and I'm a forward on the other side.
Which side were you on?
Well, you know what side I was on because Gordon was left-handed.
Yeah, your right side.
So I was on the left side of the court so I could dribble to the middle with my right hand. Yeah. And he was on the left side, on
Did
the right
have
side
a
of the court.
Left to right deficiency or a right to left? I forget.
Oh, man. And so he was about to, he was so mad at Gordon. But my dad, who never came to many games, I mean, he came to one game a year. And he would come on a weekend where he could watch. He'd come on Thursday, watch Friday, Saturday, and go back home on Sunday, driving to Chicago, to and from Chicago. So my dad is sitting in the bleachers. Actually, he's sitting in a chair at practice, which never happened because no one ever got to watch practice. And Coach is furious with Gordon, and he walks over to Gordon and says, "Now, Gordon, am I going to have to get on you with Mr. Robinson sitting with, no, he said, with Craig's dad sitting over there? You don't want me to go off with Craig's dad over there, do you?" And it was one of those that
his ears were shaking.
It was, you could see Gordon, his face turns flush. And after practice, everyone came up and they said, "Hey, Craig, can your dad come to practice more often? Because Coach Carrill really is chilled when he's there."
Yeah. Well, that says a lot about your dad, as we know. Well, anything you want to add, Craig?
No, Mitch, I mean, you've known me a long time, and you know how I feel about Princeton and the experience that can be had here. And it's just one of those special places, irrespective of Princeton basketball. But Princeton basketball is a great conduit to the rest of the university. And to be able to come back now and be in those reunions that I thought I'd never be in when I was first here, the old guys reunion. It's just fun to be able to come back and share some time with you and the other former players and get to know my daughter's class. It's just a real treat, and I'm happy you're doing these podcasts because I cannot wait to hear the guys you're going to have come up after me. This is just a great idea, and thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. This is a tough act to follow, but you've gotten us started off in the right way, and I'm thrilled that you made time for this and that we could spend some time together here at Princeton. Thanks a lot, Craig.
My pleasure.